So every time about this year, you know, some memories begin to hit me. And frankly, my faith begins to crack. It was New Year's Eve. Pamela and I had just returned from a vacation, a Christmas vacation in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where we had spent Christmas with my mom and dad and with my sister Debbie and my sister Marty and her husband and friends that I had grown up with in Las Cruces at New Mexico State and Las Cruces High School. And we had stayed there until about the 30th of December. We had had a nice long vacation with them there. And we were planning a New Year's Eve dinner out with a couple of friends of ours from Criswell College. And the librarian and his wife there, and we were getting dressed for dinner. And we got a phone call, and it was my sister Marty. And she was telling us that my sister Debbie had gone to the ER complaining of some pains in her feet and in her hands and in her back. And that the physicians in the ER had looked over her, weren't able to make a diagnosis, and just about the time they were going to check her out and let her go home, she went into convulsions in the ER room, and passed away. And I remember Marty calling us before Debbie was dead to tell us that that she had had this episode and the doctors were tending to her. And we immediately threw everything we had into our suitcases, got a friend to take us to DFW, and before we boarded the plane, we called Marty to check in, and I'll never forget Marty's words. I called and said, how's Debbie? And Marty said, she's gone. That was unexpected, losing a sister. Very unexpected. Debbie had been sick for quite some time. In her early 20s, she had been diagnosed with a tumor on her pituitary gland and had to endure several brain surgeries over the years. And so in one way, it wasn't entirely expected, but there was nothing leading up that would have made us think that Debbie was headed towards that kind of an end. John, you remember? You picked us up a few nights later after the funeral and drove us back to our apartment on a snowy, cold, bitterly cold January night. John Lippert is the back table back there. John and I have been friends since the early 80s when we were both attending classes at DTS. So every time about this year, that memory comes back. One thing that brought it back even stronger this year was I was on the phone to a friend at Southwestern Seminary, one of their professors there, and I just happened to call him to check in on him, and he was sounding kind of blue, and he said, yeah, man, today's not a good day, Jeff. He said, today is the birthday of my brother. His brother had committed suicide about 8 years ago. You just don't expect things like this. You expect your parents to die while you're alive. And I'll never forget my mother's almost complete inability to bear the loss of a daughter. You don't expect your children to precede you in death. But this side of resurrection, children precede their parents in death more often than we would like. I've got a dear friend here in the Metroplex who has struggled with difficulties with his son in just the last few years. I remember I was on a speaking trip to North Carolina, and he calls me up and says, we found my boy almost passed out in the car, rushed him to the hospital, and he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Just a young little boy, going to face the rest of his life struggling with diabetes. He'll be okay, but boy, my buddy just didn't expect that. A couple of years later, he was diagnosed with some learning disabilities, and that was just one other stone in the pile, in the backpack that he had to wear. You know, just sometimes these things just begin to pile up. And it's particularly those things that are always with you, where, you know, maybe it's not a huge boulder, but stone upon stone upon stone just keeps being added to your backpack. And you just feel weighed down and overburdened. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes, like a mirror that has had a stone cast into it, my faith begins to crack. And sometimes the most that I can do, as I've shared with you all before, is simply to eke out, "Lord, I hope it's true." I don't know if you all have ever felt like that. Maybe your lives are just mountaintop to mountaintop. Maybe your experiences are glory to glory and abundance to abundance, but none of my friends have that kind of a Christian experience. And I'm really suspicious of anybody that would tell me theirs is. And so it's interesting, but around Christmas time is a time in which, I don't know about you, but I need the testimony of God's word more strongly this time of year than I need it just about any other time of year. We've got terrible suffering in this class, terrible cases of heartache, heartache that just won't go away, and every day seems to bring another boulder into that backpack that has to be carried. And so this morning I want to continue our look into the book of Mark. For all of us whose experience isn't victory to victory, abundance to abundance, or mountaintop to mountaintop, for all of us in this classroom who sometimes look at our heart of faith and it appears to be like a mirror that has had a rock cast into it and the cracks begin to appear, I want you to notice with me what takes place in Mark chapter 8. During those days, another large crowd, verse 1, gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the seven loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well, and he gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up seven basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present, and having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. This is the second time that Jesus has fed a huge crowd of people. So as I was reading the story, maybe you were thinking, gosh, Jeff, it just seems that we covered this chapter already. But the reason why you thought that was because this is the second time that Mark gives us the account that Jesus fed huge groups of people. Maybe it was more than just twice that he did this, but Mark only records two of them. Maybe these were the only two. We don't know for sure. What we do know is that on a repeated schedule, right, Jesus willed to feed those who had no food with which to feed themselves. Notice what takes place in verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. You know what? I'm such a Pharisee. Because when things keep happening to friends of mine that they are almost too weak to bear, I begin to cry out to God for signs. All right, Lord, just this once, would you perform a miracle like you did when you parted the Red Sea? All right, Lord, just this once, would you perform a miracle in this person's life like you did when you fed the 4,000 or the 5,000? Just this once, Lord, would you begin to act again in my day as you did in the days of old? I remember just a couple of months ago, I was on my way to Europe, and I stopped through Houston because I couldn't get a flight out of Dallas the day that I wanted to, so I was going to fly out of Houston. Met with somebody from our Houston campus down there for dinner, and he came by my hotel to pick me up, and as soon as he picked me up, he passed me his iPad, which was wirelessly connected, and which already had a web page open. And he didn't say a word. He just passed me the iPad and told me to read and look at this web page. And I began to read it, and I could not believe my eyes. A Christian leader in Houston, a very prominent Christian leader in Houston, not unconnected to Dallas Theological Seminary, but not employed by Dallas Seminary at that point, had his picture displayed on this web page, and it was the web page of a lady of the evening in Houston. And it had just come to light that this man had been carrying on a long-term relationship with this prostitute. sometimes you just wonder, are the boulders ever going to stop being put into your backpack? Can there just be one day in which a boulder is taken out rather than put in? Can you split the Red Sea today? Could you raise a dead man today? Could you feed 5,000 today? And I don't know about you, but you begin to look for signs and you begin to call upon God for signs. Lord, I'll renew my faith in you. Lord, I'll get over this mountain if you do this. Lord, I'll get through this day if you'll do this. Lord, I'll be able to make it through this week if you do this. And so you begin, like the Pharisees, to call upon the Lord to do a sign that will convince you that God really is in charge, that he really is tender and loving towards you, and he really is interested in displaying his power within your experiences. And so you begin to say to God, I will if. I will when. And when we use that language to God, when we make God the object of our conditionalities, I will if, I will when, you and I have become Pharisaic. And we are dictating to God conditions under which we will trust him again, under which we will believe in him again, under which we will have confidence in him again. I'm using language this morning from my own heart. Just this semester, I've been extremely bothered by the direction of some evangelical seminaries and choices that they're making in the directions in which they're going in contemporary theological education. And as an educator, as one who is involved in Christian education every hour of his life almost, nothing can burden me quite like watching theological education become something which is preparing men and women for ministry in a less efficient manner. And so I have found myself praying for certain training schools around the country, asking God to split the Red Sea. Just this once, in this case, would you divide the Red Sea again? And then I will know that you care. Then I will know that you haven't given up. Then I will know that you are as concerned about these things as I am. I am a fool when I do that, and I am Pharisaic, because like the Pharisees, I am looking for a sign, and I am dictating the terms which will convince me. The disciples, verse 14, had forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. In other ways, he is here warning them in metaphorical language, in figurative language, to watch out for the teaching and for the priorities of the Pharisees and of the Herodians. The Herodians want to maintain a nice, peaceful alliance with the Romans, and their concern is merely political expediency. The Pharisees want to maintain their priority in the religious system, and so their interest is a self-interest of religious control and religious domination. And so Jesus warns his disciples to watch out for the tendency to be Pharisaic in its rejection of Jesus in preference for their own religious perspective, and in the Herodian rejection of Jesus out of preference for political expediency. That's what he is warning them about here. Notice verse 16, how they respond to this counsel. They discussed this with one another and said, "It is because we have no bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" They answered, 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Mark, more than any other gospel, gives us a glimpse into the faithlessness of the disciples in relationship to the teaching and to the miracles of Jesus. Here you see that despite the fact that they have witnessed two miraculous feedings, they are still struggling with understanding who Jesus is, and they're still struggling with believing in his sufficiency and in owning the fact that he is the Messiah that is going to deliver them from their sins and bring righteousness and peace to the earth. Despite the fact that they have witnessed these miracles with their own eyes, they're still struggling to believe who he is. Mark shows them in very plain, honest terms, but here in chapter 8 is not the only place that you've seen it. Come back with me to Mark chapter 6. For some reason, Mark shows this to us in a clearer way than any other gospel. Chapter 6, verse 51 and 52. "Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened." Chapter 7, verse 17. "After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. 'Are you so dull?' he asked. 'Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from the outside can make him clean?'" Look at the way Jesus talks to these guys. "Are you so dull? Are you so hard of heart?" Chapter 8, verse 21, we've just seen it. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Chapter 8, verse 33. "But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. 'Out of my sight, Satan,' he said. 'You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men.'" Look at the faithlessness of the disciples, and look at the sternness with which Jesus rebukes them. Chapter 9, verse 10. Jesus had just said this in verse 9, "As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone that they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant." Come on! How many meanings does rising from the dead have? Chapter 10, verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. This following, of course, right after the prophecy that Jesus will be mocked, spit upon, flogged, and killed in verse 34. Chapter 14. Mark chapter 14 and verse 37. Then he turned to the disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for one lousy hour? Lousy is in some manuscripts which are more trustworthy than others, but which do not appear in most of our translations. Chapter 14, verse 50. Doesn't this verse make you sad? Then everyone deserted him and fled. Everyone deserted him and fled. Chapter 14, verse 66. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said, and went out into the entryway. You know what? I take comfort in these passages. I take comfort in Mark's portrayal of the disciples' lack of understanding, of their hardness of heart, and in their weakness in faith. You know why? Because my faith has cracks in it. And sometimes it seems as though not only is my world not confirming the gospel, but sometimes it seems as though the experiences in my life are not only failing to confirm the gospel, but everything is working and running just as fast as it possibly can to deny the gospel. And so if you struggle because your days seem more filled with boulders being added to your knapsack and no boulders being taken out, and the same old things plague you again and again every single day, and you struggle to be faithful and to understand, and you find yourself weeping more often than you smile, questioning more often than you give answers, then I want you to see that you are not unlike those men who one day changed the entire world through the Spirit that was in them. Growing in faith is a process. Becoming a faithful disciple is a process which includes moments of struggle and of doubt and of hardness of heart and of questioning. Do not feel as though you are strange if your life in Jesus imitates the lives of the disciples, because growth in faith is a process. But the wrong thing for us to do is to demand signs from He who has already manifested Himself to us. You understand the problem is not with God's insufficiency in providing us information about himself. The failure is not God's to reveal himself to us. The weakness is not with God because he is somehow holding back something that would ultimately convince us if he pulled the curtains back. You understand, the problem is not with God. It's not that God is withholding a sign, refusing to do a miracle, slow in answering his promises. The problem is not with God and the fact that somehow, like some mean or ineffectual stage manager, he is keeping the curtains closed on what will convince you. The problem isn't with God. The problem is with us. And we need our hearts to be remade. Because God has already shown us in Jesus Christ everything that is necessary for faith and godliness. And so even though at this time of year, every year, the tears flow a bit more easy, and sadness comes a bit more overpowering. Because of the passages that this time of year sends me to, it also is a time of faith building. Would you leave Mark's gospel and come with me to Luke's for just one brief moment this morning? Mary's song in the Gospel of Luke, when she reflects theologically upon what is happening with Elizabeth and with her and with their babies. I want you to note what she sings. Verse 46 of chapter 1. And Mary said, "My soul praises the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior." And then she lists a whole bunch of reasons, but I want you to see in particularly verse 54. "Because he has helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, even as he said to our fathers." I want you to see that Mary recognizes that the child who is within her womb is God's fulfillment of promises he had made long ago. And even though this time of year is a time in which doubts can ascend, this time also points us back to biblical passages because we understand that the time of Christmas is a time in which God showed himself as he truly is, a keeper of his word, a fulfiller of his promises, and one who will always do what he said when he said he would do it. Not only Mary's song, but also Zechariah's song. Verse 68, chapter 1. "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come and has redeemed his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he said through his holy prophets of long ago. Salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father David to rescue us from the hand of our enemies and to enable us to serve him without fear. Notice again that when Mary and Zechariah sing, their songs are about God's faithfulness to remember and to do and to perform what he had promised. Dearly beloved, we don't need any more signs, because God has already spoken to us in his prophets and now in these last days through his Son, Jesus Christ. And he has already said to us everything that we need to know. We don't need him to part the Red Sea today. We don't need him to raise a dead person today. We don't need him to heal a sick person today. He does not need to do anything more today because he has already been shown to be faithful to what he has said through his prophets and his apostles and in these last days through his own Son, Jesus Christ. And so even though this time of year is a time in which those cracks within my heart seem to lengthen a little bit more, and every time one of my friends or a member of my family has one more boulder added to the knapsack, and even though every day may come with another failure in ministry, this time of year, because of its reminder to me of the faithfulness of God to what he has already spoken, this time of year is also a time of faith building. God needs to say, God needs to do nothing more to win your faith. Because he has already said everything that we need to know through his prophets and his apostles, and in these last days through his own Son, Jesus Christ. Don't search for signs. Don't ask for signs. Retreat to the sufficiency of the Holy Bible. This is adequate. And so, Father, I pray that you would strengthen our confidence in what the apostles and the prophets have written, in what your Son has said. Help us to be content and satisfied with what you have already done and with what you have already said. And help us to confidently look forward to what you will do in fulfilling what you have already said. I ask that you would strengthen my brothers and sisters in faith. Give those who suffer confidence in your word and in your faithfulness. I ask it through Christ and by the Spirit. Amen.